Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Patrick Mahoney from Manhead Merch. First of all, Spotify plans on going public this year, and if that happens, Warner Brothers, Warner Music Group, has stated that they're willing to give some of the profits that they get when Spotify goes public back to the artists. What's more, Sony Music has stated exactly the same thing. Well, that's a big twist, isn't it? Up until now, what's happened is anytime the record labels, the major record labels, have accepted a large advance from one of the streaming services, digital music services, all of that money has gone to the label's bottom line. So very little actually made its way to the artists involved with the label. But this may change now that Warner's said that they're actually going to take some of this money that they may make or they may not, because we still don't know that Spotify is going to do this, and we don't know exactly how much money it's going to be worth. Anyway, Warner's and Sony have both said that they're going to at least give some of the money back to the artists. Now, the interesting part is the fact that we don't know exactly how much, because they haven't stated what percentage of this profit they'd give back to the artist. But one of the things we do know is that Spotify is worth about $8 billion right now. The major record labels own about 15% of that. So Warner's percentage is somewhere around $200 million. So how much of that will actually go back to the artists? That will be interesting. Now, another thing that's interesting is the fact that Universal Music Group has not said anything on this lately. They haven't given an inkling as to whether they're going to join in or not. But this is a definite change in the stance from the record labels. Now, why are they doing this? Well, to some degree, it's a preemptive strike, because artists already are very conscientious about what's going on with streaming music. And as I've pointed out, there's more money being made than most people think, but most of it remains with the record labels. So in order to keep the controversy down, my presumption is that they've decided that they would basically throw a bone to the artists. Once again, we don't know how much this is going to be. It may only be 10%. However, it's kind of nice that artists are going to get paid if and when something like a Spotify IPO would actually come to pass. So anyway, that's what's supposed to happen this year, or at least that's what Spotify tells its investors and potential investors. So we'll see. It should make for an interesting year. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I just launched a new mini coaching program called Lead and Background Vocal Mixing Tricks, as well as a live mixing workshop where I'll personally help you with your mixes. You can go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. That's bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Now let's talk about mastering compressors. Once upon a time, unless you were willing to spend a whole lot of money, it just wasn't possible to get the same devices, the same mastering compressors and limiters that most of the big time mastering engineers were using. Of course, that's all changed now, since just about everybody can afford the same mastering plugins that most of the high profile mastering engineers are using. That being said, just because you own the hammer, it doesn't mean you know how to swing it. So let me give you a couple tips. If you're using a mastering compressor or limiter, either across your stereo bus or maybe across a drum bus, or maybe you're using it for mastering yourself, for self-mastering, here's a couple of tips. The first thing is, slower releases make any kind of gain changes less audible, but they also lower the perceived volume. A slow attack tends to ignore drum transients and other real fast signals, but it still is fast enough that it interacts with the vocals and the bass. The only problem with this is it might allow a transient to overload your next plugin. So that's why usually there's a compressor followed by either another compressor to catch that transient or a limiter. And you'll find that most mastering engineers will use that signal path. In other words, they'll use a compressor or several compressors very, very gently, not adding a lot. And then they'll follow with the limiter. And in many cases, mastering engineers kind of hate limiters. So what they tend to do is use a number of compressors in a row. but each one is doing just a little bit. It's being very, very gentle so you don't hear it. And usually the ratio that they use is somewhere like 1.5 to 1 or 2 to 1. It's very, very gentle. And there's only a dB or two that's hitting each particular compressor. So you find that you don't hear it as a result because you're not really hitting any of them hard. Something else to keep in mind, any kind of gain changes that are caused by drum hits can wind up pulling down the level of both the vocals and the bass, which basically will cause the overall volume to change as well, which is not something that you really want. That's why you have to really concentrate on how you set that attack time and basically the release time as well. The big secret to using compressors and limiters is how you set the attack and release time. Another thing to keep in mind is the more bouncy the meter is, in other words, if you look at your level meter, the more it bounces, the more likely that the compression is going to be audible. And that's usually because your attack time and release time are set very, very fast. Now, there's nothing wrong with setting fast attack and release time, but sometimes if you set it way too fast, that's when you risk actually hearing the compressor working, which is not something that you usually want. The other thing to look out for are quiet passages that suddenly seem way too loud or they're really, really noisy, because that's a giveaway that you're overcompressing things. So again, the tendency is sometimes we like compression so much that we just want to add more and more and more and more. But there comes a point in time where we get to the point of diminishing returns, usually with compression, just like EQ, just like effects, less is more. And it's just finding where that point is that really makes a difference. So next time you break out that mastering compressor, just remember that how you set the attack and release really makes the difference in how it's going to work for you. My guest today is Patrick Mahoney from Manhead Merch. Manhead licenses an artist brand, then takes care of all the merch needs from design to concert sales to retail distribution. I spoke with Patrick from his New York office via Skype. Tell me how Manhead got started. What was the genesis of all that?
Well, the genesis of Manhead was the founder's name is Chris Cornell, and like a lot of things in the music industry, there's like, you know, it's actually quite a small group of people that sort of move from place to place. And I, you know, Chris and I had actually worked together. You know, it must have been 1999 or 2000 at a company called Blue Grape, which was owned by Roadrunner Records before they were bought by Warner Brothers. When that sort of got sold to Bravado, he you know, I moved on to do something and he went on to do this, and he literally started it in the, you know, people say they start things in their extra bedroom. He literally did. I saw it, you know, and he started with a band called the All American Rejects, and it was just printing stuff for them and shipping out to the road. And over the last 7 or 8 years, you know, he's grown it to, you know, a pretty sizable company with offices in New York, where I'm sitting now, and in Nashville, where I actually live, with 12 or 13 employees and full channel merchandise solutions, retail, online, touring, and we do it worldwide. There was the good days and the bad days in between.
Yeah. Well, what makes the company different? Because there's a lot of merch companies out there.
I think that what makes us different is that you know, because, you know, we're both about the same age, and I think that matters in this industry, that we came into it when the big companies, like there was companies called Brockham or Niceman or Winterland, like the sort of original innovators came in, and they had created a certain business model or process that's how we learned to do it. Mm-hmm. But then we sort of also came up in the sort of DIY ethic as well. I mean, we're all, one common thing about everyone that works here pretty much is we're all in bands, you know, failed bands, but bands. We all come from that DIY ethic, and I think we were able to mix, you know, and I, you know, I'm not sure if it was consciously or self-consciously, but, you know, it's easy to look back and say, oh, we did that on purpose. I'm not sure we did, but, you know, we mixed the two, and, you know, we wanted to be able to, you know, we learned how to provide service worldwide. We learned how to do royalty payments and structure deals and all that sort of stuff. But we also understood that the bands that we were dealing with, you know, they had different expectations than maybe they'd back in the 80s or the 90s. I mean, they were, quality became a huge issue. You know, even over the last 15 years, the amount of times that I actually talked to band members directly, as opposed to doing everything through management. I mean, that's flip-flop from like 80-20 to, you know, from 20-80. And it's a lot more hands-on. We have to create a product, I think, that that addressed all those things. But we wanted to have the solid financial backbone, and we wanted the worldwide distribution. And I think, you know, the companies that sort of started since, you know, and I don't mean to disrespect anybody, but I think that, you know, I think that sometimes they don't necessarily get into all channels, or they don't sort of operate globally like we do.
When you started, you weren't starting globally, were you?
I think we had all come from companies that had done that. And so on the first day we had to start again, we realized that, but Chris always knew where he wanted to go. And we definitely knew where we wanted to go.
And you know how to do it if you came from a company that,
and we knew how to do it. And I think, you know, that's, you know, you can't be everything to everyone. And sometimes we just, you know, some bands just don't require that sort of extra level of, you know, whatever words you want to use, knowledge base or whatever, but you know, some do. And I think that's our niche, you know?
Yeah.
Mixing the old and the new. I hope I explained that.
Yeah. Yeah. I get it. You know, I was looking at your website, and it seems that like a big part of your business is designing the merch, or designing the graphics for your clients, where I notice with, I think it's most other companies that are similar to yours, it's almost like you supply us the graphics and we'll do the rest. But it seems like that's a big part for you.
Well, you know, I mean, that probably is actually a good way to speak to what I was talking about earlier is, you know, we want to be rights management, a rights management company, as opposed to just a order processing company. You know, there's plenty of people out there that you can call up and you can send them your art, and they can print you t-shirts, and they can ship them bulk to wherever you want them shipped, and probably be a little bit cheaper than us. But we like to take artwork ideas. We like to create artwork from those ideas. We like to create them specifically for products. We like to create those products specifically for different distribution channels. You know, and when we like to manage a band's artwork and sort of visual intellectual property, as opposed to just sort of wait for the phone to ring. So in any typical, like someone like Fall Out Boy, for example, we try hard to have an online, specific online product range. And we try to have a specific tour product range. And we deal with designs with Hot Topic, for example, that are exclusive to Hot Topic. And we're always generating, you know, these sort of purpose specific artwork, as opposed to saying, okay, here's five designs. Let's run with these for, you know, for 9 months until we feel like everyone's bought them. It's a constant management process, and in some ways the fact that we manufacture and ship out t-shirts is sort of the byproduct of what we're trying to do, which is, you know, just create a revenue stream through licensing the art.
Yeah, you're coming from a different place then completely.
Yeah.
Most other places are more or less fulfillment, and your rights management, that's completely different. It's a different mindset.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm making sense.
Yeah. No, I get it. I get it. That's very cool. So I guess that must mean that you do a lot of custom artwork for specific channels, and whenever there's a reason to change, you're adaptable to change then for, you know, a new tour that's coming up or a specific event or something.
Yeah, I mean, the way we structure things is we'll have someone on staff that's pretty much sole job is to sort of be, I guess it's the sort of merchandise version of an A&R person. And they're the ones that sort of drive that process. So if I've got the retail people need a new range of designs, or our European retail partners need new designs, or there's a tour coming up where we want to run a special on the online store, we're actually going to that central location and having, you know, that member of the staff, you know, sort of coordinate that with the bands. So it's, you know, it's almost like a hub and spoke where we put the band in the center, and then we push and pull out to each channel. That's basically how it's structured.
Okay. Who's your client mostly? Are they signed artists or DIY artists? Who makes up
mostly signed? I mean, you know, I mean, Fall Out Boy's obviously our biggest. We also work with Train, Panic at the Disco, some sort of older classic stuff like Yes and Moody Blues, Dashboard Confessional. We do an Irish dance tour called Celtic Woman. We're into some character licensing things. We do just start working with Doug the Pug, which is a like a Facebook and Instagram sensation. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I mean that's probably the bread and butter. You know, that said, we're still music fans for sure, and we sign stuff early because we like it a lot. You know, and you know, hopefully 20% of those will turn into something to keep the lights on.
But
you know, the it's actually, you know, really exciting to sort of get something early. I mean, a lot of our competitors, like, you know, it's more of a commodity business for them. They're sort of buying and selling, something they can pre-value. You can pre-value a Rolling Stones tour. You can pre-value anything like that. For us, it's still like, wow, this is a great band. I mean, I don't think we'll ever lose that.
That's cool. Well, of course, if you're players before or still, you have an affinity what they're doing because you're in the trenches. You kind of know what that's supposed to be, right?
You know, I mean, just think we're a sort of a boutique-y company. I know that's the most overused word in the English language these days, but boutique-y company with a you know a solid, well-run, well-thought-out, proven, you know, global distribution network.
Yeah. What are the new trends in merch?
They're sort of incremental, to be honest. I mean, we still sell. I could line up 10 or 15 great products of the year and then sort of have to admit to you afterwards that we still sell about 85% black t-shirts. But in the last year, bags, like tote bags, have done well. We've done a lot of screen printed sort of like hatch style posters have done really well. Seeing tie dyes coming back. Huh. But a lot of things are cyclical, you know. Just looking over here. Different patterns of camo still work in different garments. Done a lot of jackets this year, like Letterman jackets or sort of punk rock vests that we sort of sew patches on. Mugs, pint glasses in Europe, the proper ones with the little bubble on the top.
Yeah.
Done harmonicas for a couple of clients this year.
Jeez.
Actually.
Wow.
What else? You know, stuff like that.
Okay.
But you know, other trends that from a revenue perspective ours is, you know, in the last year we probably tripled our involvement in selling VIP programs.
No kidding.
Yeah.
What's a typical one like?
Well, you know, for us, it's with a lot of medium-sized artists, we had to find a way to create value in a maybe a 1,000-seater where, you know, someone who buys a $50 or $75 VIP gets something out of it where they could probably just stand in front of the building and wait. If they wait long enough, you know, the singer is going to come off the bus, right? Yeah. So we had to create something. So, you know, a lot of sound checks, a lot of meet and greets, but really sort of not just like, you know, grin and grip lines, like really intimate meet and greets where it's a good 15 or 20 minutes of actually just hanging out. Mm-hmm. A lot of incentives, like early shopping at the merchandise store, a lot of specific memorabilia, really nice laminates and things like that.
Yeah.
I
noticed, was it Sidestep? Was mm-hmm. that the is that a third party app or is that something that you guys own or how does that work?
Well, we're investors in it.
Oh, got it. Okay,
but it is a third party app. You know, it's a passive investment though. Those guys are off doing their thing. We probably were the first company to use them and beta test and which was cool because we had a lot of feedback. You know, we helped with the. Helped with a lot of the process, you know, but it's great. I mean, that's, you know, there's we've had situations with the right band where, you know, we're adding, you know, dare I say 15 or 20% to the sales, you know,
and that's just because it's easier than standing in line.
I think perhaps, but you know, it's when I'll go to a show, like, I'll ask these kids why they use it and you know, you get different answers, but they're sort of all seem to be in the family of, this is what I'm used to.
Oh yeah.
I'm getting used to using my app to dial up anything. And though it, maybe it's a new application for them, it's like they already speak that language and they're happy to do a credit card process through an app as opposed to, you know, it's just sort of a current convenience thing or whatever, you know?
Okay. Well, just so I have this straight. So does that mean they buy it through the app and then they collect the product there as well, or is it sent to them?
What happens is we upload all the products from a tour into the app, and you have a couple options. You can actually pre-order the stuff and have it shipped to your house. Say if you want to wear it to the show, say 3 weeks out, we'll open those sales up. But where we get most of the sales is really on site, where someone will put in their order, the credit card will be processed right away, and then they just go to one of the stands that are designated for the pickup, and it's almost like a concierge valet service at that point.
Yeah, got it.
There'll be a bag waiting for them. So they can get it on the way out. They don't have to carry it around. I mean, there's just different. People have different reasons for wanting to do it, but it always boils down to something they're just getting familiar with, using an app.
These aren't connected with beacons by any chance, are they?
Nope.
Because that would be kind of interesting to have beacon technology talking to an app.
What do you mean by beacon?
Well, it's kind of a new thing where if you walk by a beacon, you'll get a text message on the app. Yep. It will pop up and say, hey, there's a special deal on, you know, whatever. I mean, that's one of the cases.
Yeah, we call it someone else. If anyone comes to one of the Fall Out Boy shows this spring, well, February and March, we're going to be doing something similar to that.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. It's cutting edge. That's neat. Yeah. Definitely.
So not many trade secrets in this business, but I'm gonna deem that one a trade secret and say, just wait. You have to wait till the Fall Out Boy tour.
All right. So you opened up a company opened up a Nashville office. How long ago was that? That was recent, right?
About a year and a half ago.
Okay. Fairly recent.
We had a couple guys that were already down there. And so we got a spot just off Music Row. And then I actually moved there from LA July 1st of last year.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess 7 months into my Tennessee life, and it's a great town. It's a fantastic town.
Yeah, it is. You know, big difference from LA, isn't it?
You know, but I mean, it's literally, you know, people talk about how different it is and how sort of grounded and rootsy it is. And you sort of just sort of hear that. But, you know, not to go too far off topic, but my wife and I just, and my son, we just recently, this weekend, actually adopted a dog. And it turns out the woman that runs the adoption agency has a publishing company. her husband's like a songwriter.
Yeah.
And, you know, now I got to go to a Hootenanny next week. You know what I mean? And they're right around the corner. You know, but that happens all the time.
It's so Nashville, isn't it?
It literally does. I mean, it's great. It's completely refreshing because, you know, to me, LA turned very transactional.
Yeah.
You know, and New York's New York, so it gets a pass. But it seems to be going that way too. But, you know, Nashville's a place we can literally go out and see real talent any night.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
Here too, but it's something about it. Maybe it's the water. I don't know, or the air.
Well, that's a place I always enjoy visiting. I have a lot of friends that live there. I'm in LA now, but I have a lot of friends that moved there. And it was a quality of life issue for many of them. And for many of them, it was, you know, a big part of the business is there now. And I guess that must be the same for you, where all of a sudden there's more business there than in other places, especially with country music being so hot these days.
Yep. And there's a lot of rock there too. I mean, you know, there's a lot of rock managers have moved there in the last couple of years.
I always felt it was such a cosmopolitan city, musically cosmopolitan. And even, you know, back in the 80s when I first started to go there, when country music was still country music, the old country music, there was still such a rock presence. It was interesting, and it was something that no one, unless you lived there, it didn't sink in, you know, that there was more going on than just country.
No, it's a great place, definitely a great place. I think, and I'm sure it's going to keep growing.
Do you find that your country clients require something different than, let's say, your rock clients?
No, I think that, you know, I think everyone's looking for, when they come to us anyways, I mean, they're looking for sort of a quality product and a compatible approach. You know, I it's not much different, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, the venues are different. Some of the cities are different, you know, but it's still the same stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Or same expectation, and you know, maybe the design aesthetic's a little bit different, but not so much. I mean, especially with the stuff that we do. You know, we're still sort of doing that sort of alternative country and sort of fits in with our sort of rock aesthetic, you know?
Sure, sure. GoMerch is what? It's your online arm, right? Your online division.
It's just the trade name, really.
Yeah. Oh, so your online shopping cart, really, or shopping cart for your artists, yeah.
Yeah.
How much of your business is coming from e-commerce? Is merch still something that's an impulse buy, so to speak, that, you know, happens at venues, happens during the event?
No, I think people go to shows with, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get a t-shirt. Here's my night. I'm going to go in. I'm going to check out the merch. I'm going to go find my seats. I'm going to see the opening band. I'm going to go get a soda, pick my t-shirt. You know, I think it's maybe an impulse in the design, but I think people definitely come in knowing it's going to be part of the night's activities. Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Well, speaking of which, then price is a big factor involved. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who sets the price? Does that come from you? Does that come from the artist or management? Huh? And what do you find is the upper limit that you can charge for like a t-shirt?
Well, you know, personally, I think the upper limit's probably 30. There are situations where between what we owe the artists and what the artist wants and what we may have to pay to sell in a specific building that we're pushing up to 35 or sometimes even 40. I don't know if we've gone any higher than 40. Seems like that might be our upper limit.
I've seen some for 45, but you know, again, that seems like it's way high compared to what you're getting. And there was a superstar, and I can't remember who it was. It might have been Jeff Beck or somebody. But that being said, you know, you look and you go, that's a lot of dough for a t-shirt.
Yeah, I mean, you know, which person do you want me to be? The businessman or you know, the old punk rocker? You know, I mean, it's like I remember paying $5 for shows and $10 for t-shirts.
Yeah,
and that was my youth, you know. And so I'll have to admit, I hope it doesn't hurt our business. I was pulled kicking and screaming into this new reality, but you know, I mean, we try to, you know, I mean, I will say that for all companies too, is those days of the t-shirts falling apart after first one wash, I think those are pretty much gone across the board. I mean, I think quality has come up considerably over the last 15 years.
Yeah,
you know, quality of the cotton and the quality of the printing technology. So there's that, but you know, I don't think a kid has more than $40 anyways. I still can't figure that one out.
Yeah, right, right. Well, what's the lowest limit that you can get away charging?
Well, ironically, if you know, from our perspective, if you're lower than 25, it's hard for us to be involved as a selling partner. We can sell you the shirts on like a supply basis where you give us $5 or whatever the cost is, and you can sell them yourselves and just pay the invoices. But I'm sure we have Warped Tour type bands that still charge 15 or maybe 20.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Stuff that we're involved with ranges between 25 and 35 typically.
Where do you see merch going in the future?
I think the concert merch is always going to keep going the way it is. You know, we can enhance that experience with the VIPs. You know, I mean, we always try to find ways to not necessarily be completely vertical, but offer a suite of services that's a big chunk of what an artist might need. We've talked about getting into recorded music, not interested in that, but we are interested in obviously doing the tour merch, obviously supporting those adjunct VIP things. And, you know, we've talked about people actually investing in tours and festivals too. I mean, that's where we sort of see it going. And then there's the other side of it, of course, is just technology. We'd like to see where Sidestep goes. You know, we've got a couple other things cooking. We're all sort of tech heads. So we have like a little thing we call Manhead Labs, which is kind of our little incubator that we just run things through, you know, we'll see. Yeah.
You don't see any new items coming up then, new merch items that maybe have the potential of being hot. It's been for 50 years, 40 years anyway, where the t-shirt has been the mainstay of the business. And you'd think there'd be something else that would come along.
I mean, you sort of put me under pressure to have a great answer. You know what I mean? Like, oh, this is the merch guy. He should know. It's something that, like, you know, it's trend driven.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe, you know, maybe you're always going to have something. I think, you know, I will say this, that sort of item du jour, or like that sort of perennial or yearly item that comes out, it tends to, I think, be in the sort of middle bucket We try to, when we put together lines, we think in terms of what we call buckets, where you've got your premium apparel, which is like your hoodies, and you've got your tour shirts, and then you've got maybe some sort of, usable accessory. And then you've got like stickers or badges or a program. So I think it might be $5 or $10. The sort of products of the day are definitely in that accessory bucket, I would say. 10 times out of 10, whether it's a hat, this year's hat, or like I said, the bag, or we're doing a lot, those campfire mugs are speckled.
Yeah.
Like it's an old, yeah, those are big now. I mean, it's just a play on a mug, but we're selling a lot of those speckled mugs. A lot of trends and colors, though. I mean, we do try to, especially with our more fashion-forward, poppy or sort of youth bands, we try to push, this year's color palette.
Which is what? What's this year's color palette?
It's like a maroon. Hmm. And I know it's a color that we're pushing. I'm older and like wearing these sorts of shirts for the last 20 years, so I'm not really the guy in charge of fashion here. But when I understand from the kids, sort of purples, like darker purples and maroons and things like that.
Okay.
Which I'm sure will change by the summer.
Yeah, right. Let's go back to the VIP package. Mm-hmm. What's in a package? Is it generally a meet and greet? Is there some merch involved? How do you put a package together?
Like a baseline package would be you get sort of an exclusive commemorative piece of merch. I like to, you can never go wrong with a t-shirt, right? It's wearable and it's durable and it lasts. And it's something it's very generalist item,
Yeah.
Like to do laminates, like special laminates, commemorative laminates, almost like, how the really nice baseball cards now with the watermarks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That kind of thing seems to be popular, or some sort of printed passport. One thing that we've done is like sort of ripped off the passport concept, and it's a small, it's got the really nice, like, I don't know what kind of material, that Tyvek material that's the outside of a passport, and we just sort of, make it look like, it's just a small little tour book. We've done a couple of those for VIPs, the passport into the backstage or whatever the metaphor is. And then, you bundle that up together and then you throw in the experience. So the sound check viewing is sometimes good, especially if you've got a band that can do a couple songs acoustically.
Mm-hmm.
That's always cool, And then again, going to when we try to limit these things to 15 or 20 people where it's sort of a, it becomes almost like a circular group of like a discussion as opposed to like a line where people just shaking the guy's hands and you're the great, and then moving on. So we just try to, like, it's more of an intimate thing.
See, I always thought that it was management that put those things together, the meets and greets and the VIP experiences, but it makes much more sense for a company like yours to do it because it's easier to put that package together.
Well, we've got people out there already selling. So we try to build it in such a way where there's some cost savings and some economies of scale.
Yeah. Retail is a big part of your business as well, right?
Certain bands, yeah.
Yeah.
And license, yeah.
And that's not always easy to put together, especially that there's so much merch competition out there that it must be really difficult. You must have separate people then that are just doing that.
Yeah, we have, we do. I mean, we have a licensing people and retail people. That's all they do.
It puts you in a different class than most other companies.
Than some. Well, the thing about retail is, I mean, the market has just shrunk. I mean, when I first got started, there was, 3,000 independent record stores and specialty stores. I mean, it's back in 1993 or something, it was like, that was the time, right? And Helmet and Nirvana and all those bands, and it was still strong CD selling base and the kind of music that we sort of specialize in was that they got its first shot at being popular, and it's great. I mean, we were selling tons of sort of alternative rock bands to the thousands of online independent record stores and Spencer Gifts and Hot Topic and Record Mart and Trans World and Miller's Outpost. That turned into Anchor Blue in California. I used to do rock shirts, and I know I'm missing a ton, and they're all gone.
Yeah,
They're all gone. There's maybe 300 independent stores, and there's Hot Topic and Spencer Gifts, and if you have something ironic enough, Urban Outfitters. And that's the market.
Yeah,
I remember we used to sell Slipknot shirts to JCPenney, tens of thousands of them.
Really.
Yeah, back in 96 or 97 or 98, maybe. I don't remember. but I had hair then. I know that. yeah, that just doesn't exist anymore. You know, I mean, Target does a rock program, but it's the, you know, the Beatles and the Foo Fighters, and you know, it's the very top of the line.
Yeah.
Where, you know, so it shrunk, but you know, we maximize it. You sort of replace it by, I think that what there's been an uptick in, like, being able to take those images and going to a third party and doing third, you know, different products that we license the images out to, you know, basic stuff like posters, but you know, to toys, like something like, oh, like Doug the Pug, we're going to work on a toy line.
So that's, I mean, an untapped market, actually. It's an untapped merch piece, I think. It's a great idea.
Yeah,
very cool. All right, last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you've learned or someone imparted to you along the way in your career?
I can't attribute this to one particular person, but when I started listening to people when they're saying you need to keep it simple, like the structure of your business, say, and the way you do it, and keep your overhead down, and when I started to listen to that, things got a heck of a lot better, for sure. You know, I mean, there's no need to open up offices in every city, London, in Australia anymore. You don't need to have a company structured with six different businesses and have 100 employees. I mean, that's probably the best piece of business advice that I've ever got. But I think it's sort of universal, isn't it?
You would think. I don't think there's enough companies that operate that way, but certainly to get that advice. But it's really difficult sometimes to keep it that way. I think you actually have to work at keeping things simple these days.
Yeah. I mean, the sort of joke around here is that the higher the bank balance is, the more bullshit we can put up with.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because we're doing good.
Yeah.
So am I allowed to say that on this? I don't know.
Yeah, you are. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's very cool. Great. Thank you, Patrick. This is great. It was enlightening. Like I knew it would be, and I enjoyed speaking.
I hope I did okay. I think it's my second podcast ever.
It was great. So. It was great. Thanks, Patrick. Okay. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
To find out more about Patrick and Manhead, go to manheadmerch.com. That's Manhead, M-A-N-H-E-A-D, merch, M-E-R-C-H, all one word, manheadmerch.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. We love your questions and we love your comments. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, or Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.